Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Larkin, Judge Reyes, the Honorable Randall J. Sleater presiding.
Good morning.
Morning.
You may be seated. And welcome to the Court of Appeals, December 11. We have six matters on the court's calendar. Three will be live. One's partially live through ITV later this morning. The first matter is A190801, the appellants Daniel Lee, Ray Lee, Trifecta Deals Corporation, respondents Joel Paffrath and Chris Paffrath. And as counsel aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes to present its argument, 15 minutes to respond, and then a 5-minute rebuttal if you wish. We do ask counsel if you would identify yourself for the record when you do approach the podium. And you can adjust the podium if you need to. And as soon as appellant's counsel is ready, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Carl Christensen. I represent the appellants in this matter. The question before this court today is simply, when should a court exercise jurisdiction over a party to also deny that party the right for its claim to be heard on the merits? I know that the court's reviewed the facts. The most seminal fact in this matter is my clients had interposed an answer and raised jurisdictional defenses in that answer. Nonetheless, the lower court ultimately entered default judgment against all the defendants. Part of the challenge in this case is that the lower court's orders are so succinct and short, it's difficult to understand how to address the issues. It's like stabbing a fog, walking through what the jurisdictional arguments could have been and what the substantive arguments could have been. What we do have is a very sparse record related to jurisdiction. There's nothing. And my clients did raise the jurisdiction issue in their answer. There were two motions for default judgment, and neither of them were they raised. In the first motion against Trifecta, the issue
was— Can I ask you about that, Mr. Christensen?
Yes, sir.
Do you see a distinction between your client, Trifecta, the corporation, who had a default hearing, I think it was almost a year earlier, as I recall, and versus your individual clients, the Lees? And in particular, do you see a distinction with the fact that the corporation, as I understand it, had counsel present at the default hearing and had counsel present? The only other hearing was a telephone conference, as I understand, earlier in that year. But in that first year of the life of this lawsuit, the attorney present did not raise or re-raise, other than in the answer, the personal jurisdiction. Do you see that as an important distinction between, as I understand, I believe you were present or someone from your firm at the second hearing for the Lees over a year later?
Mr. Wilcox from our office was present for the proceeding against the Lees, and so implied in the court's question is the observation that indeed Mr. Wilcox and our firm, on behalf of our clients, raised that in the briefing opposition to the motion for default judgment. Going back to the Trifecta motion for for default judgment, the implied question is, did they waive it by not raising it? And
indeed,
I will say
it's an accurate summary of the question.
Right, and so it's not in the briefing. You will see from the transcript that the attorney that was present had just been retained 2 days prior and was asking to approach that hearing as if it was a sanctions hearing. He said, look, we're here because of the discovery violations, and there's a sanction that's appropriate that's not basically default judgment. And if you apply the appropriate sanction, he admitted, look, this case has not been handled well on behalf of defendants, but I'm here to change that. And so he didn't raise the issue, but at the same time, he approached it as if it weren't ripe. And he did say, I want to be able to interplead other parties, and I want this case to go forward on the merits. So the question is, was there a waiver? A waiver would require, and the case law says, related to waiver, and that's the the Patterson case, it would require the attorney to interface with the case on the merits. So the question is, does the appearance of the New York attorney in the discovery meet and confer, or was it a discovery motion? I can't forget if it was in front of the court or not, but the discovery appearance and then the subsequent appearance of the attorney related to the motion to dismiss, were any of those actually on the merits, or were those merely appearances related to discovery? Clearly, the attorney, when he showed up, said, if you're going to sanction my client, do it in a different way. We'll admit that we've done things wrong related to discovery, but we want this case to go forward. The case law in the Patterson case looks for a much higher level of interface on behalf of the attorney.
Was not the second hearing, though, the one in the fall where attorney was present, part of the notice was default judgment. So even though sanctioned, the point being is, would that not be a motion on the merits for which counsel, I understand it was David Schneider, was present, did not raise the issue of personal jurisdiction or the corporation?
Well, that's the chicken and egg sort of conundrum that we're in here. What was the motion? Surely was stylized as a dispositive motion, but the underpinnings of it were non-dispositive in nature, were a discovery violation. He approached it as if it were he didn't. He was, first of all, he was retained 2 days before. So there's another argument that if he should have been able to have the time to present a more robust defense of the underlying claims. But that being said, the only issue was, should the court penalize my clients because they didn't participate in discovery? That, by nature, is a non-dispositive question, but the magnitude of the discovery violation, as severe as it was, took it into a dispositive motion context. That is not the context in which people have been seem to have waived jurisdiction. And those contexts in the Patterson case that I was trying to dig out in my notes says that appearing in a substantive, a dispositive motion where you're actually arguing the substance of the claims would be, and not raising it there, participating substantively in the case in other ways would be, but this case begs the question of, where is that line? If this were merely, I can think of, and the court gives examples of de minimis contacts with the court that would not constitute a waiver. And in that Patterson case, they say that discovery issues and representation and interfacing with discovery issues are not enough. So the question is this a discovery issue or not? And if the court's inclined to say it's not, I would ask it to say, to look at it, where is the line then where it, a discovery violation no longer is a discovery violation? Is it merely because they asked for the draconian remedy of a motion to dismiss? I would say that that's not a line that this court should be drawing. I think the other thing is, the case law says once it's raised, the burden is on the plaintiffs to rebut that. It wasn't on the defendants to subsequently bring it up again when they've already brought it up. And likewise, because the underlying, at a minimum, this court could remand to the lower court and say, there's no findings related to jurisdiction. Clearly the issue was in front of you. If it was waived, then tell us what the legal underpinning for why that was. If it wasn't waived, then we remand for further findings on jurisdiction. In the normal course of actions, when it's not arising in the context of this procedural posture, it would be appropriate for the lower court to say, you know what, I am not sure what's happening, but jurisdictional discovery seems to make a lot of sense here.
Would it be safe to say that wherever the line is, in any event, that the line was closer to being crossed, from your position, perhaps not crossed, but closer to it with regard to the corporation where the issue is not raised versus the Lees individually? Part of the reason I'm asking that is is it safe to, the record demonstrates there was no raising of the issue for the corporation through that default hearing, nor was there, once an order is received from that, that if it was a surprise, a request for reconsideration on that basis, there was, basically it's not raised until over a year later in response to the default judgment of the Lees individually.
Well, the delay is immaterial because we're raising it here now, and this is the appropriate course to do that. Reconsideration doesn't necessarily strengthen or weaken, from my opinion, strengthen or weaken my client's position as it relates to trifecta and whether or not it waived its jurisdictional defense. However, I do agree with the court that clearly the Lees did not waive that. So there is a difference in terms of if there is an issue of waiver, whether or not trifecta did. I said earlier it would be appropriate for this court to ask the lower court to make factual findings related to that. But we're here today because my client, clearly trifecta contests that did not waive that.
Right, but I think you raise a good point in terms of the difference between the Lees and trifecta. You acknowledge that, well, you argue that the Lees did, in fact, did not waive it because they did raise the issue when about a year later the motion for default judgment came up with respect to the Lees. But with trifecta, they did not raise that issue when that motion came up.
I'm agreeing that the Lees' raising of the issue clearly shows that they did not waive it. And I'm also saying there's a question, if this court thinks there's a question by them not raising it, whether or not they waived it, I'll concede that there is a question of that. But I don't believe that the delay contributes to that question because we're here today. They have...
Well, but that's a separate issue, whether or not we... we're reviewing what the district court did and what issues were raised before the district court to allow the district court to make a decision, including whether or not it even had jurisdiction in the personal jurisdiction in the first instance. Because if it didn't, then it wouldn't even need to proceed on that. And so, I mean, I think it is an issue of what was raised before the district court.
And I was just distinguishing whether or not a motion for reconsideration would change this court's review. It's my opinion that it wouldn't, because their jurisdictional issue was preserved in the answer.
The joint answer when from both parties, right from the get-go, you mean?
Right, and okay. once the court ruled against them and didn't address the issue, the next timely step would be to bring it before this court. Any other interview? Sure, we can bring a motion to consideration. I don't think that is evidence as to the timeliness of the question, is all I was trying to say.
Right, but there's still an issue of whether or not it was raised appropriately before the district court so the district court could make a decision and actually address that issue.
Yes.
Okay.
Going into the substance of the defaults themselves, the defaults against both parties were brought for purported discovery violations. And the question is the sanction of dismissal or of default judgment an appropriate discovery sanction? And contemporaneous with that analysis, is it appropriate to bring a motion for a default judgment at that time? Normatively, the choice of whether or not a discovery sanction is appropriate would be an abuse of discretion standard. But here, because it's tied to a dispositive result, we argue it would be a de novo review would be appropriate. Regardless, the lower court abused its discretion in selection of default judgment as the remedy against both parties for discovery violation. We go through at great length the different standards this court can apply in evaluating the discovery, the standard. The most important would have been the determination of what prejudice the plaintiffs were suffering for the purported discovery violation. At that point, related to trifecta, the violations were reportedly threefold. One, not providing initial disclosures, not responding to discovery in a timely manner, and also not participating in the origin and cause investigation. Looking at those all together, the first two you can look at together, the not providing initial disclosures, not responding to discovery, they had already been sanctioned the monetary amount for those purported violations. Related to the third, not participating in the origin and cause investigation, that is that they cannot participate at their own will. That's just an evidentiary proceeding, and what the court said is if they don't participate, they can't later bring a claim for spoliation. They can't later claim, look, we can't defend these claims because the evidence has been removed or destroyed. That in itself is what the court indicated the result would be, not that somehow by not participating, they're waiving their rights to bring defenses that they wouldn't need by participating in the origin and cause investigation. More profoundly, when it relates to the lees, the only purported violation related to discovery was not filing their initial disclosures. There was no discovery that had been propounded to the lees, and there were no motions brought related to discovery that hadn't been propounded to the lees. And in fact, once we appeared, we provided the initial discovery disclosures. So while late, they cured that default before it was brought before the in the context of what would be an appropriate measure in that context, which would be bring a motion to compel or otherwise a motion for sanctions for the non, sorry, I see my time is up. May I finish my thought?
You may finish your thought and then you'll have a chance to rebut.
Would be the a penalty for not providing them sooner, but in this case, the penalty instead was over $1 million judgment against the individual lead defendants. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent, you may approach and respond.
May it please the court, David Watson on behalf of respondents Chris and Joel Paffrath. If it feels as though we are stabbing a fog, it is a fog that was created by appellants. Appellants continually refused to comply with their discovery obligations. The Paffraths, at multiple junctures throughout this proceeding in the lower court, provided opportunities for all of the respondent or all of the appellants to address those issues. First, throughout multiple conversations with other counsel, asked for those discovery responses. They were not forthcoming. We then brought a motion to compel discovery. It isn't just participation in the origin and cause investigation, but the court did order that all appellants should have provided their initial disclosures. And in addition, they did order that Trifecta should provide its answers to discovery. They failed to respond to that. Finally, we brought a default motion against Trifecta based on those failures, those continued failures.
Mr. Watson, can I?
Yes.
The order the judge issued in May of 2017 in response to the motion to compel, I don't see in that order that there was a warning, should we say, if compliance did not occur specifically, and no warning that a dismissal would be brought. Would it be safe to say at least that factor that the appellants would not be aware that that was imminent for failing to comply?
Whether or not that was made clear in the court's order at that time, certainly in the court's scheduling order, there are two relevant deadlines and sanctions noted. Failure to comply can include dismissal of the action, and that applies to both parties. That is at the end of the court's scheduling order. There's another point that's made in the court's scheduling order, which is a November 1st, 2017 deadline for any dispositive motions, which would include, under Rule 12, any motion to dismiss for lack of personal jurisdiction. So the various points at which the defendants could have raised that issue, the appellants could have raised that issue, are multitude.
Right, but those are, I understand those are there and they're written, they're provided to the parties. But what we're talking about is not only discovery sanctions, and there's already a discovery sanction for the failure to provide the initial disclosures of several thousand dollars, but what we're talking about here is looking at the five factors to determine whether or not the court actually gave a warning of potential sanctions for noncompliance. And the sanction here, it was complete dismissal. So that's an incredibly severe sanction rather than just a, you know, okay, you take care of all the costs that the other party has incurred because of your delay. Those are two very, very different things. And so usually what the courts look for is, was there some explicit warning given to the party more often than not after they haven't complied? Okay, you understand you didn't provide your initial disclosures. If you don't provide them now by this date, you may incur sanctions, including an up to. Is that anywhere in the record?
I can't testify to whether that's there in the record or not. I do know that...
Well, is there anything that the district court in any of the transcripts said to Trifecta and the Lees about if you do not comply with these, you've missed the deadlines, you've blown the deadlines. If you don't meet these, you know, the next deadline, you could be done.
Certainly at the hearing itself on the issue of the default, when the default judgment was noted.
But that's the default judgment hearing itself.
That is correct, Your
Honor. But anything that occurred before then?
I'm not aware of any warning that occurred, again, other than the scheduling order itself that warned the parties that failure to comply with those deadlines can include a sanction up to dismissal of the action.
What's the prejudice here?
Prejudice is twofold. First of all, as counsel mentioned, the origin and cause investigation, we multiple times had requested that they identify who the manufacturer was of the device. That information wasn't forthcoming until supposedly on the eve of the default hearing against the Lees personally.
So we're talking about information.
We're talking about information specific to a destructive examination of the hoverboard, which was essentially the entire context of the hearing the motion to compel discovery. It included the initial disclosures issue. It included the failure to respond to discovery. But there was a destructive examination of the hoverboard that took place that any other potentially liable parties should have been present for. And so the failure to provide that information is a potential prejudice to the PAFRAS claims against any other potentially liable parties. It isn't just a delay. It isn't just a delay as to the Lees or Trifecta itself. But in these cases where you have other potentially liable parties that had that information and they willfully withheld it until nearly 2 years later, on the eve of the default hearing.
Was that information requested from the Lees specifically?
That information was requested from Trifecta.
So it was not requested from the Lees?
It was not requested from the Lees. Okay. Not in a discovery request, but it should have been, again, part of their initial disclosures. If they have information and parties that they are going to rely upon, we talked about earlier the issue of discovery as to personal jurisdiction. If they had defenses and people who had information relevant, we would have had an opportunity to depose those people, to serve discovery relevant to that issue. None of that took place because no initial disclosures were provided.
Instead of a default judgment, could the district court have precluded the defendant from asserting those defenses at trial, blaming other people who were not involved in the destructive testing of the hoverboard?
Again, that's a possible sanction. Whether the court abused its discretion in awarding a default, I think, is the question.
Right, but courts prefer trials on the merits.
That is correct. That is correct. I know the Rimel case, State v. Humphrey v. Rimel, discusses that issue, that we prefer a trial on the merits. However, when you do have a party or parties who refuse to participate in the litigation in a meaningful way, I know that the case talks about you forfeit a trial on the merits as to those issues.
Was the jurisdictional challenge pending during the time that Trifecta refused to cooperate with discovery?
To be clear, there was no jurisdictional issue pending.
Why not?
Because
wasn't it raised in the answer?
How? The answer was never filed by appellants. It was attached to our default, but it was never actually filed and before the court. And Rule 5 talks about the parties are responsible to actually file any pleading in front of the court. So our position is that this issue was never properly raised. The Patterson case, and the site, pin site here is at 869, 608 Northwest, 863 at 869. Talks about that it is incumbent on the parties, I'm paraphrasing, but it is incumbent on a party with a defense to raise it, to bring it before the court in a meaningful way. The failures of appellants to bring it up, it was they never filed their answer, they never brought a Rule 12 motion, which Rule 12 itself says if a jurisdictional, not subject matter, but if a personal jurisdiction issue is not raised, it is waived, it is forfeited. At the motion to compel discovery, at the default hearing against Trifecta, they could have brought a Rule 60 motion. Black versus Rimmer is a case that is cited by appellants. That is 700 Northwest 2nd 521. And if you look at those factors about what a court should look at in a default, it's four things: reasonableness of the defense on the merits, reasonable excuse for failure to answer, due diligence after default, and the question that we've been bandying around is the issue of prejudice. But all four of those elements talk about issues and defenses that a person, that default judgment is going to be rendered against, should raise. They didn't. If there's a void in this record about those issues, it's not on the plaintiff in a case to prove a negative, that there is no reasonable defense.
Mr. Watson, there's no dispute that your client would serve the answer which has the personal jurisdiction raised in it. Would not service be sufficient to have raised the issue such that the burden now is on your client, at least at a prima facie level, to demonstrate personal jurisdiction?
Your Honor, I don't believe so. I think that Rule 5 does state very clearly that a party must provide a pleading and file it before the court. It's not up to us then to bring a motion to sort of somehow overcome their defense, but the burden is on a defendant to bring the issue before the court. Had that been brought up, our first response would have been under Rule 5404, that plaintiff is entitled to fact discovery about this issue. The very things that we had asked for from Trifecta, we would have asked for from Trifecta again. We would have asked for from the Lees themselves. Provide information relevant to your defense of lack of personal jurisdiction. At no point during any of these proceedings did appellants file an affidavit. Did they file an exhibit? And so if they are pointing at a lack of information, that is on them. That is squarely on their shoulders.
Let me just clarify, then, Mr. Watson, the first default hearing, again, it was over a year earlier with regard to Trifecta, the answer would have been attached to the motion for default.
Correct.
So would that change the scenario with regard to personal jurisdiction in your mind? Now the court has it before it, related to the Rule 5 argument you're making a year later, when now your client wishes default judgment against the Lees individually.
Whether procedurally it's proper to bring an issue before the court attached through another party's exhibit, I don't think that the rules provide any guidance to that. I do believe Rule 5 clearly states a party must file pleadings. Any pleading that must be served should be filed, and it wasn't. The courts typically talk in a default context at the Court of Appeals about examining a record after a Rule 60 motion. A Rule 60 motion, again, would have been another opportunity for appellants to flesh these issues out. They never brought a Rule 60 motion, not after the first default, not after the second default. Again, it is incumbent, as Patterson says, it is the burden is on the plaintiff, or I'm sorry, on the defendant who is faced with a default to raise that issue. The day that default motion was served, an appropriate response could have been file a motion. File a motion to dismiss for lack of personal jurisdiction. Again, we would have responded under Rule 5404 and said, we need fact discovery on this issue. None of that occurred. Judge Reyes, back to your point about could there have been some other lesser sanction? The court itself, in its motion to compel, already had awarded a financial sanction on them. What else could they have done? The court could have done other things, but the question here is whether the court actually abused its discretion, whether it fell so far outside the bounds. It's not what I would have done. It's not even what this court necessarily would have done. It's did the court abuse its discretion in defaulting a party who willfully and without justification failed to defend this action? Your Honor, I believe that burden has been met.
There's only a minute left. Can we turn quickly to the personal jurisdiction question,
yes.
Particularly with respect to the lees? Because that seems to be very tenuous.
Your Honor, again, I think that the court examined the issue of whether the lees effectively were acting through trifecta.
Right, basically piercing the corporate veil.
Correct.
How did they how is piercing the corporate veil apply in this case?
Again, we think it is that the court, that we proved it is more likely than not that it was merely a shell for the lees. First of all, the lees identified only themselves as people who had relevant information. They said, we have relevant information to trifecta and the running of this company.
Right,
and yet they only identified themselves. I think there is a fair inference there that there is no one else.
Well, why is that relevant if you've got basically a small company that's run by a handful of people?
Right.
They're the owners. They're the managers.
I'm out of time. I want to answer your question,
if I
may.
Finish your thoughts in response to Judge Reyes.
Again,
question.
The Rymel case, I believe, speaks directly to that point that a piercing the corporate veil claim, someone may have viable defenses. Those are defenses. And they are defenses that someone who hopes to be defended from liability should bring up, should raise, and provide evidence for. That's information that we did ask for in discovery through trifecta, and it's information that the lees should have provided in their initial disclosures that would have allowed continuing discovery on that issue. Whether it's thin, again, in the judgment of the court was satisfied, and whether that's an abuse of discretion, I think the evidence and the inferences were there, that there was no evidence provided by the lees that any corporate formalities were followed. So again, we would ask that the lower court judgments be affirmed in this matter. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you may have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. This case, I said before, the waiver issue as it applies to trifecta is really on the cusp of what can constitute waiver. Let me just read into the record what the Patterson case says. While participating in litigation through discovery and responding to an opposing party's motion are not sufficient to waive the defense, that's the defense of lack of jurisdiction, moving for a decision on the merits of part of the claim invites the court to exercise its authority on behalf of the moving party and implicitly acquiesces to the court's exercise of jurisdiction over that party.
Mr. Christensen, you disagree, and if so, how, with Mr. Watson's point that under Rule 5, the fact that the answer is never filed, it's not before the court, the defense itself, and until it was attached to the default motion. Do you disagree with the legal analysis that puts it in this scenario, a different scenario that would behoove your client to bring a motion, which apparently it never did, under Rule 12?
I think I do disagree.
Okay.
That answers the court's question. The Rule 5 does not overcome the service rule. We in Minnesota, we commence a case by service, not by filing, and indeed the case, the engine of the case starts by service. In the court said in both hearings that an answer had been interposed. In fact, relying on that, we had assumed it had been filed when we took effect, but the analysis then would be, why would the service of the answer not be sufficient to put the plaintiffs on notice to the claims and defenses of the party? That's the standard. Are they on notice? And by the mere fact that service of the answer is sufficient to fulfill the requirements of interposing an answer, I think it would be a rather tortured analysis to say that somehow, while fulfilling the requirements of notice pleading, it didn't fulfill the requirements of bringing a jurisdictional defense. Which it says, the case law says, the court has to ostensibly bend over backwards to hear the jurisdictional defenses because it's not up to its discretion to determine jurisdiction. It must follow the law.
Counsel, were plaintiff's discovery requests related in any way to the jurisdictional defense?
I don't know. I did not review them in preparation for this hearing, and I was not the attorney that received the propounding of those discovery requests. I apologize, I can't answer that more directly.
How would, under Rule 5.04, though, after service, filing has to be made with the court within a certain period of time, within a reasonable period of time?
That's correct.
But that was never done here, right?
Well, they filed the answer, and
It wasn't filed by Trifactor or the Lees, though.
I don't believe so.
Okay, so how is it properly before the court?
Because the court said that it received and it construed that the answer had been filed. It said that an answer had been interposed and served on the other parties. That issue wasn't raised by the lower court. It accepted the service of the answer as the giving notice of the claims and defenses of the parties. So, like I said before, to go from there to the step now where somehow my client is barred from raising a defense because they knew of it, they had it, but it wasn't filed, I don't agree with that analysis, and I don't know of any case that says that. We couldn't find any. And in fact, the record says that an answer was served. The other question that this case begs, it comes up in the, going back to the Patterson case, the counsel that appeared hadn't filed anything. He just appeared, was hired to as before. He appeared at the hearing. He basically said, Your Honor, you're right. My clients have not done what they're supposed to do related to discovery. I'm sorry. You can penalize them, but this is too far beyond what the penalty should be. And by the way, we intend on bringing our defenses and bringing the defense, for instance, of my clients aren't the manufacturer, he said in that hearing. So the plaintiff's argument today that my clients hadn't raised any defenses and they weren't participating in the litigation is not borne out by the testimony in that hearing. Also, what this case begs, namely, related to our appearance, but of any attorney's subsequent appearance in a case that's already commenced, is what should the standard be for the court? Even if there were discovery violations, I see my time has run out. May I finish my point?
You may finish your thought, yes.
What should the court do? And I think if I were to give my opinion and what I would hope for, and especially hope for in this case, is that we, the new attorney, especially us appearing now, we get the benefit of the doubt that we are going to change the tenor of the participation in the case, move the case forward in an expedited fashion if need be, but get the claims and defenses before the court, take our lumps on the discovery violations of the past attorneys, but do the best job we can to our clients in the case that's currently before the court so it can be heard on the merits. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your briefing and your answers to our questions today and your comments, and we will take the matter under advisement.
Great. Thank you.
Happy holidays to you.
Happy holidays.
want to check, Jake? Thank you. Good morning.
You go ahead, you're in.